1.2 When Ferguson was 6, his mother told the story of how she had nearly lost him. Not lost in the sense of not knowing where he was, but lost in the sense of being dead, of exiting this world and floating up to heaven as a bodiless spirit. He wasn't yet a year and a half old, she said, and one night he began running a fever, a low fever that rapidly shot up to a high fever, just over 106. An alarming temperature, even for a small child, and so she and his father bundled him up and drove him to the hospital, where he started going into convulsions, which easily could have done him in, for even the doctor who removed his tonsils that night said it was touch and go, meaning that he couldn't be certain whether Ferguson would live or die, that it was all in God's hands now, and his mother was so scared, she told him, so horribly scared she would lose her little boy, that she nearly went out of her mind. That was the worst moment, she said, the one time when she believed the world could actually come to an end. But there were other rough spots as well, a whole list of unforeseen jolts and mishaps. And then she began enumerating the various accidents that had befallen him as a young child, several of which could have killed him or maimed him, choking on an unchewed sliver of steak, for example, or the piece of broken glass that went through the bottom of his foot and required 14 stitches, or the time he tripped and fell on a rock, which tore open his left cheek and required 11 stitches, or the bee sting that swelled his eyes shut, or the day last summer when he was learning how to swim and nearly drowned when Cousin Andrew pushed him under the water. And each time his mother recounted one of these events, she would pause for a moment and ask Ferguson if he remembered. And the fact was that he did remember, remembered nearly all of them, as if they had happened only yesterday. It was mid-June when they had this conversation, 3 days after Ferguson had fallen out of the oak tree in the backyard and broken his left leg. And what his mother was trying to demonstrate by going through this litany of small catastrophes was that whenever he had hurt himself in the past, he had always gotten better, that his body had hurt for a while and then had stopped hurting. And that was precisely what was going to happen with his leg. Too bad he had to be in a cast, of course, but eventually the cast would come off and he would be as good as new. Ferguson wanted to know how long it would take before that happened. And his mother said a month or so, which was an extremely vague and unsatisfactory answer, he felt, a month being one cycle of the moon, which might be tolerable if the weather didn't become too hot, but "or so" meant even longer than that, an indefinite and therefore unbearable length of time. Before he could get himself fully worked up over the injustice of it all, however, his mother asked him a question, a strange question, perhaps the strangest question anyone had ever asked him. "Are you angry at yourself, Archie, or angry at the tree?" What a perplexing thing to throw at a boy who hadn't even finished kindergarten. Angry? Why should he be angry at anything? Why couldn't he just feel sad? His mother smiled. She was happy he didn't hold it against the tree, she said, because she loved that tree. She and his father both loved that tree, and they had bought this house in West Orange mostly because of the big backyard. And the best and most beautiful thing about the backyard was the towering oak that stood in the center of it. 3.5 years ago, when she and his father had decided to leave the apartment in Newark and buy a house in the suburbs, they had looked in several towns, Montclair and Maplewood, Millburn and South Orange, but none of those places had the right house for them. They felt weary and discouraged from looking at so many wrong houses, and then they came to this house and knew it was the one for them. She was glad he wasn't angry at the tree, she said, because if he had been angry, she would have been forced to chop it down. "Why chop it down?" Ferguson asked, beginning to laugh now at the thought of his mother chopping down such a large tree, his beautiful mother, dressed in work clothes, as she assaulted the oak with an enormous gleaming axe. "Because I'm on your side, Archie," she said, "and any enemy of yours is an enemy of mine." The next day, his father returned from Three Brothers Homeworld with an air conditioner for Ferguson's room. "It's getting hot out there," his father said, meaning he wanted his son to be comfortable as he languished on the bed in his cast. "And it would also help with his hay fever," his father continued, preventing pollen from entering the room, for Ferguson's nose was highly sensitive to the airborne irritants that emanated from grass and dust and flowers. And the less he sneezed during his convalescence, the less his broken bone would hurt, since a sneeze was a powerful force, and a big one could resonate throughout your entire body, from the top of your whiplashed head to the tips of your toes. The 6-year-old Ferguson watched his father go about the business of installing the air conditioner in the window to the right of the desk, a far more elaborate operation than he would have imagined, which began with the removal of the screen window and called upon such things as a tape measure, a pencil, a drill, a caulking gun, 2 strips of unpainted wood, a screwdriver, and several screws, and Ferguson was impressed by how quickly and carefully his father worked, as if his hands understood what to do without any instructions from his mind, autonomous hands, as it were, endowed with their own special knowledge. And then came the moment to hoist the large metallic cube off the ground and mount it in the window. Such a heavy object to lift, Ferguson thought. But his father managed it without any apparent strain, and as he completed the job with the screwdriver and the caulking gun, his father hummed the song he always hummed when he fixed things around the house, an old Al Jolson number called Sunny Boy. You've no way of knowing, there's no way of showing what you mean to me, Sonny. His father bent down to pick up an extra screw that had fallen on the floor, and when he stood up straight again, he suddenly grabbed the small of his back with his right hand. Ach und wei, he said, I think I've strained a muscle. The cure for strained muscles was to lie flat on your back for several minutes, his father told him, preferably on a hard surface. And since the hardest surface in the room was the floor, his father promptly lay down on the floor next to Ferguson's bed. What an unusual advantage that was, to be looking down at his father stretched out on the floor below him. And as Ferguson leaned over the edge of the bed and studied his father's grimacing face, he decided to ask a question he had thought of several times in the past month, but had never found the proper moment to ask. What had his father done before he became the boss of 3 Brothers Homeworld? He saw his father's eyes roam across the ceiling, as if searching for an answer to the question, and then Ferguson noticed the muscles around his father's mouth pulling downward, which was a familiar gesture to him, an indication that his father was struggling to suppress a smile, which in turn meant that something unexpected was about to happen. I was a big game hunter, his father said, calmly and flatly, betraying no sign that he was about to launch into the most egregious load of nonsense he had ever imparted to his son. And for the next 20 or 30 minutes, he reminisced about lions, tigers and elephants, the sweltering heat of Africa, hacking his way through dense jungles, crossing the Sahara on foot, scaling Mount Kilimanjaro, the time when he was nearly swallowed whole by a giant snake, the other time when he was captured by cannibals and was about to be thrown into a pot of boiling water, but at the last minute he managed to wriggle out of the vines that were strapped around his wrists and ankles, outran his murderous captors, and disappeared into the thick of the jungle. And the other time when he was on his last safari before coming home to marry Ferguson's mother and was lost in the darkest heart of Africa, which was known as the Dark Continent, and wandered onto a broad, endless savanna where he saw a herd of grazing dinosaurs, the last dinosaurs left on Earth. Ferguson was old enough to know that dinosaurs had been extinct for millions of years, but the other stories seemed plausible to him. Not necessarily true, perhaps, but possibly true, and therefore worthy of being believed. Perhaps. Then his mother walked into the room, and when she saw Ferguson's father lying on the floor, she asked him if anything was wrong with his back. No, no, he said, I'm just resting. And then he stood up, as if his back were indeed fine, walked over to the window, and turned on the air conditioner. Yes, the air conditioner cooled off the room and cut down on sneezes. And because it was cooler, his leg didn't itch as much under the plaster cast. But there were drawbacks to living in a refrigerated chamber as well. The noise, first of all, which was a queer and confusing noise, since there were times when he heard it and times when he didn't. But when he did hear it, he found it monotonous and unpleasant. But worse than that, there was the matter of the windows, which had to remain shut in order to keep the cool air in. and because they were permanently closed and the motor was perpetually running, it couldn't hear the birds singing outside. And the only good thing about being cooped up in his room with a cast on his leg was listening to the birds in the trees just beyond his window. The twittering, chanting, warbling birds who made what Ferguson felt were the most beautiful sounds in the world. The air conditioning had its pluses and minuses then, its benefits and hardships. And as with so many other things the world doled out to him in the course of his life, it was, as his mother often put it, a mixed blessing. What bothered him most about falling out of the tree was that it needn't have happened. Ferguson could accept pain and suffering when he felt they were necessary, such as throwing up when he was sick or letting Dr. Gustin jab a needle into his arm for a shot of penicillin. But unnecessary pain violated the principles of good sense, which made it both stupid and intolerable. A part of him was tempted to blame Chucky Brower for the accident. But in the end, Ferguson realized that was no more than a feeble excuse. For what difference did it make that Chucky had dared him to climb the tree? Ferguson had accepted the dare, which meant he had wanted to climb the tree, had chosen to climb the tree, and therefore he himself was responsible for what had happened. Never mind that Chucky had promised to follow Ferguson up if Ferguson went first, and then had backed down from his promise, claiming he was scared, that the branches were too far apart and he wasn't tall enough to reach them. But the fact that Chucky hadn't followed him up was immaterial, for even if he had been there, how could he have prevented Ferguson from falling? So Ferguson fell. He lost his grip while reaching for a branch that was at most 1/4 of an inch beyond the point where he would have been able to grasp it securely. Lost his grip and fell. And now he was lying in bed with his left leg imprisoned by a plaster cast that would remain a part of his body for a month or so, meaning more than a month, and there was no one to blame for this misfortune but himself. He accepted the blame, understood that his present condition was entirely his own fault, but that was a far cry from saying the accident couldn't have been avoided. Stupid, that's what it was, just plain stupid, to have forged on with his climbing when he couldn't fully reach the next branch. But if the branch had been 1 particle of an inch closer to him, it wouldn't have been stupid. If Chucky hadn't rung his doorbell that morning and asked him to come outside and play, it wouldn't have been stupid. If his parents had moved to one of the other towns where they had been looking for the right house, he wouldn't even know Chucky Brower, wouldn't even know that Chucky Brower existed, and it wouldn't have been stupid, for the tree he had climbed wouldn't have been in his backyard. Such an interesting thought, Ferguson said to himself, to imagine how things could be different for him, even though he was the same. The same boy in a different house with a different tree. The same boy with different parents, the same boy with the same parents who didn't do the same things they did now. What if his father was still a big game hunter, for example, and they all lived in Africa? What if his mother was a famous movie actress and they all lived in Hollywood? What if he had a brother or a sister? What if his great uncle Archie hadn't died and his own name wasn't Archie? What if he had fallen out of the same tree and had broken 2 legs instead of 1? What if he had broken both arms and both legs? What if he had been killed? Yes, anything was possible. And just because things happened in one way didn't mean they couldn't happen in another. Everything could be different. The world could be the same world, and yet if he hadn't fallen out of the tree, it would be a different world for him. And if he had fallen out of the tree and hadn't just broken his leg, but had wound up killing himself, not only would the world be different for him, there would be no world for him to live in anymore. And how sad his mother and father would be when they carried him to the graveyard and buried his body in the ground. So sad that they would go on weeping for 40 days and 40 nights, for 40 months, for 440 years. There was a week and a half to go before the end of school and the beginning of summer vacation, which meant he wouldn't miss enough time to flunk kindergarten because of too many absences. That was something to be thankful for, his mother said, and surely she was right, but Ferguson wasn't in a thankful mood during those first days after the accident, with no friends to talk to except in the late afternoon when Chucky Brower would stop by with his little brother to look at the cast, with his father gone from morning to night because he was at work, With his mother driving off for several hours a day in search of a vacant shop to house the photography studio she was planning to open in the fall, with the housekeeper Wanda mostly busy with her washing and cleaning, except when she brought lunch up to Ferguson at noon and helped him empty his bladder by holding the milk bottle he was supposed to pee into instead of doing his business in the bathroom. Such indignities he had to bear, all for the stupid mistake of having fallen out of a tree. And to add to his frustration, there was the fact that he hadn't yet learned to read, which would have been a good way to pass the time. And with the television downstairs in the living room, inaccessible, temporarily out of bounds, Ferguson spent his days musing on the imponderable questions of the universe, drawing pictures of airplanes and cowboys, and practicing how to write by copying the sheet of letters his mother had made for him. Then things began to brighten somewhat. His cousin Francie finished her junior year of high school, and for several days before she left to work as a counselor at a summer camp in the Berkshires, she came to the house to keep him company, sometimes for just an hour, sometimes for three or four. And the time he spent with her was always the most enjoyable part of the day, no doubt the only enjoyable part, for Francie was the cousin he liked best, liked more than anyone else in either one of his two families. And how grown up she was now, Ferguson thought, with bosoms and curves and a body similar to his mother's. And just like his mother, she had a way of talking to him that made him feel calm and comfortable, as if nothing could ever go wrong when he was with her. And sometimes it was even better to be with Francie than his mother, for no matter what he did or said, she never got angry at him, not even when he lost control of himself and became rambunctious. Clever Francie was the one who came up with the idea to decorate his cast, a job that took 3.5 hours, such careful brushstrokes as she covered the white plaster with an array of brilliant blues and reds and yellows, an abstract swirling pattern that made him think of riding on an exceedingly fast merry-go-round. And as she applied the acrylics to his new and detested body part, she talked about her boyfriend Gary. Big Gary used to play fullback on the high school football team, but was now in college. Williams College in the Berkshires, not far from the camp where the two of them were going to work together that summer. She was looking forward to it so much, he said. And then she announced that she was pinned, a term not familiar to Ferguson at the time. So Francie explained that Gary had given her his fraternity pin. But fraternity was a word that eluded Ferguson's understanding as well. So Francie explained again, and then she broke into a big smile and said, "Never mind. The important thing was that being pinned was the first step toward getting engaged, and the plan was that she and Gary were going to announce their engagement in the fall. And next summer, after she had turned 18 and was finished with high school, she and Gary were going to be married. The reason why she was telling him all this, she said, was that she had an important job for him, and she wanted to know if he was willing to do it." "Do what?" Ferguson asked. "To be the ring-bearer at the wedding," she said. Once again, Ferguson had no idea what she was talking about, so Francie explained once again. And when he listened to her tell him that he would walk down the aisle with the wedding ring perched on top of a blue velvet pillow, and that Gary would take it from him and then put it on the fourth finger of her left hand to conclude the marriage ceremony, Ferguson agreed that it was an important job, perhaps the most important job he had ever been given. With a solemn nod of the head, he promised he would do it. It would probably make him nervous to walk down the aisle with so many people looking at him, of course, and there was always the chance that his hands would tremble and the ring would fall to the ground, but he had to do it because Francie had asked him to, because Francie was the one person in the world he couldn't ever let down. When Francie came to the house the following afternoon, Ferguson immediately understood that she had been crying. Reddened nose, foggy pink-tinged traces around both her left and right irises, a handkerchief balled up in her fist. Even a 6-year-old could figure out the truth from that evidence. Ferguson wondered if Francie had been quarreling with Gary, if suddenly and unexpectedly she was no longer pinned, which would mean the marriage was off and he wouldn't be called upon to carry the ring on a velvet pillow. He asked her why she was upset, but rather than pronounce the name Gary, as he imagined she would, Francie started talking about a man and a woman named Rosenberg, who had been put to death yesterday. "Fried in the electric chair," she said. speaking those words with what sounded like both horror and disgust. And it was wrong, 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 she went on, because they were probably innocent. They had always said they were innocent. And why would they let themselves be executed when they could have spared their lives by saying they were guilty? Two sons, Francie said, two little boys, and what parents would willingly turn their children into orphans by refusing to declare their guilt if they were guilty, which meant they must have been innocent and had died for nothing. Ferguson had never heard such outrage in Francie's voice, had never known anyone to be so distraught over an injustice committed against people who qualified as strangers. For it was clear to him that Francie had never met the Rosenbergs in person, and therefore it was something deadly serious and important that she was talking about, so serious that those people had been fried for it. What a dreadful thought that was, to be fried like a piece of chicken submerged in a pan of hot, bubbling oil. He asked his cousin what the Rosenbergs had supposedly done to deserve such a punishment, and Francie explained that they had been accused of passing secrets to the Russians, vital secrets concerning the construction of atomic bombs, and since the Russians were communist, which made them our mortal enemies. The Rosenbergs had been convicted of treason, a ghastly crime that meant you had betrayed your country and should be put to death. But in this case, the crime had been committed by America. The American government had slaughtered two innocent people, and then, quoting her boyfriend and future husband, Francie said, "Gary thinks America has gone mad." This conversation hit Ferguson like a blow to the stomach, and he felt as lost and afraid as he had been when his fingers slipped off the branch and he started falling out of the tree. That gruesome sensation of helplessness, nothing but air around him and below him, no mother or father, no God, no nothing but the emptiness of pure nothing, and his body on its way to the ground with nothing in his head but the fear of what would happen to him when he got there. His parents never talked to him about things like the Rosenbergs' execution. They protected him from atomic bombs and mortal enemies and false verdicts and orphaned children and fried grown-ups. And to hear Francie tell him about all that in one grand gush of emotion and indignation caught Ferguson by complete surprise. Not like a punch to the stomach exactly, but more like something from one of the cartoons he watched on television. A cast-iron safe falling from a 10th-floor window and landing on his head. Splat! A 5-minute conversation with his cousin Francie, and everything had gone splat. There was a big world out there, a world of bombs and wars and electric chairs, and he knew little or nothing about it. He was dumb, so perfectly dumb and hopeless, that he found it embarrassing to be himself. An idiot child, present but not accounted for. A body occupying space in the same way a chair or a bed occupied space. Nothing more than a witless zero. And if he meant to change that, he would have to get started now. Miss Lundquist had told his kindergarten class that they would learn how to read and write in the first grade, that there was no sense in rushing things, and that they would be all mentally ready to begin next year. But Ferguson couldn't wait until next year. He had to begin now, or else condemn himself to another summer of ignorance. For reading and writing were the first step, he concluded. The only step he was in a position to take as a person of no account, and if there was any justice in the world, which he was seriously beginning to question, then someone would come along and offer to help him. By the end of that week, hope appeared in the form of his grandmother, who drove out to West Orange with his grandfather on Sunday and settled into the bedroom next to his for a visit that lasted well into July. He had acquired a pair of crutches the day before she showed up, which allowed him to move around freely on the second floor and eliminated the humiliations of the milk bottle. But descending to the first floor on his own was still out of the question. The journey down the stairs was far too perilous. And so he had to be carried by someone, yet one more insult to be endured in silence and smoldering resentment. And because his grandmother was too weak and Wanda was too small, the carrying had to be done by his father or mother, which made it necessary to go down early in the morning, since his father left for work at a little past 7 a.m., and his mother was still searching for the right place to set up her studio. But no matter, he didn't care about sleeping late, and it was preferable to spend the mornings and afternoons on the screened-in porch than to languish in the chilly tomb upstairs. And while the weather was often hot and humid, The birds were back in the picture now, and they more than compensated for any discomfort. The porch was where he finally conquered the mysteries of letters, words, and punctuation marks, where he struggled under the tutelage of his grandmother to master such oddities as where and where, weather and weather, rough and stuff, ocean and motion, and the daunting conundrum of two, two, and two. Until then, he had never felt particularly close to the woman whom fate had chosen to serve as his grandmother, his nebulous Nana from Midtown Manhattan, a benign and affectionate person, he supposed, but so quiet and self-contained that it was difficult to establish a connection with her. And whenever he was with his grandparents, his boisterous, madly entertaining grandfather seemed to take up all the room, which left his grandmother in the shadows, almost entirely effaced. With her squat, round body and thick legs, with her dowdy, old-fashioned clothes and stolid shoes with the fat, low heels, she had always struck Ferguson as someone who belonged to another world, an inhabitant from another time and place. And consequently, she could never feel at home in this world, could live in the present only as a kind of tourist, as if she were just passing through, longing to go back to where she had come from. Nevertheless, she knew everything there was to know about reading and writing, and when Ferguson asked her if she would be willing to help him, she patted him on the shoulder and said of course she would, it would be an honor. Emma Adler, wife of Benji, mother of Mildred and Rose, proved to be a patient, if plodding, teacher, and she went about the business of instructing her grandson with systematic thoroughness, beginning with an examination of Ferguson's knowledge on the first day, needing to know exactly how much he had learned so far before she devised an appropriate course of action. She was heartened by the fact that he could already recognize the letters of the alphabet, all 26 of them, most of the small letters and all of the capitals. And because he was so advanced, she said, it was going to make her job much less complicated than she had thought it would be. The lessons she subsequently gave him were divided into three parts: writing for 90 minutes in the morning, followed by a lunch break, reading for 90 minutes in the afternoon, and then, after another pause for lemonade, plums, and cookies, 45 minutes of reading out loud to him as they sat together on the porch sofa, and she pointed to the words she thought would be hard for him to understand, her chubby right index finger tapping the page below such tricky spellings as intrigue, melancholy, and thorough. And as Ferguson sat there beside her, breathing in the grandmother's smells of hand lotion and rosewater perfume, he imagined the day when all of this would become automatic for him, when he would be able to read and write as well as any other person who had ever lived. Ferguson was not a dexterous child, as his fall from the oak had proved, not to speak of the other spills and stumbles that had dogged his early life, and the writing part caused more difficulty for him than the reading part. His grandmother would say, "Watch how I do this, Archie," and then she would slowly write out a letter 6 or 7 times in a row, capital B's, for example, or lowercase f's, after which Ferguson would try to imitate her, sometimes succeeding at the first go, other times failing to get it just right, and whenever he continued to fail after the 5th or 6th attempt, his grandmother would place her hand on top of his hand, wrap her fingers around his fingers, and then guide the pencil over the page as their two hands executed the letter in the proper way. This skin-on-skin approach helped quicken his progress, for it removed the exercise from the realm of abstract forms and made it tactile and concrete, as if the muscles in his hand were being trained to perform the particular task required by the contour of each letter. And by repeating the exercise again and again, every day going over the letters he had already learned and adding 4 or 5 new ones, Ferguson eventually took control of the situation and stopped making errors. With the reading part, the lessons advanced smoothly, since there were no pencils involved, and he could fly along at a rapid pace, encountering few barriers as he moved from 3 and 4 word sentences to 10 and 15 word sentences in the course of 2 weeks. And such was his determination to become a full-fledged reader, before his grandmother's visit came to an end, was almost as if he were willing himself to understand, forcing his mind into a state of such receptiveness that once a new fact was learned, it stayed there and wasn't forgotten. One by one, his grandmother would print out sentences for him, and one by one he would read them back to her, beginning with, "My name is Archie," and moving on to, "Look at Ted run," to, "It's so hot this morning," to, "When will your cast come off," to, "I think it's going to rain tomorrow," to, "How interesting that the little birds sing more beautifully than the big birds," to, "I'm an old woman and can't remember learning how to read, but I doubt I caught on as quickly as you have." And then he graduated to his first book, The Tale of Two Bad Mice, a story about a pair of housebound rodents named Tom Thumb and Hunka Munka, who smash up a little girl's dollhouse because the food in there isn't real but made of plaster, and how thoroughly Ferguson savored the violence of their destructive fury, the rampage that followed the shock of their disappointed, unsatisfied hunger. And as he read the book out loud to his grandmother, he faltered over just a few words, difficult words whose meanings escaped him, such as perambulator, oilcloth, hearthrug, and cheesemonger. "A good story," he said to his grandmother after he had finished, "and very funny, too." "Yes," she agreed, "a highly amusing story," and then, as she kissed him on top of his head, she added, "I couldn't have read it better myself." The next day, his grandmother helped him write a letter to Aunt Mildred, whom he hadn't seen in almost a year. She was living in Chicago now, where she worked as a professor and taught large college students like Gary, although Gary was at a different college from hers, Williams College in Massachusetts, whereas her college was called the University of Something. In thinking about Gary, he naturally started thinking about Francie as well, and it struck him as peculiar that his cousin was already talking about marriage at 17, when Aunt Mildred, who was 2 years older than his mother, which made her many years older than Francie, still wasn't married to anyone. He asked his grandmother why Aunt Mildred had no husband, but apparently there was no answer to that question, for his grandmother shook her head and admitted that she didn't know, speculating that it could be because Mildred was so busy with her work, or else because she simply hadn't found the right man yet. Then his grandmother handed him a pencil and a small sheet of lined paper, explaining that this was the best kind of paper for writing letters. But before he began, he should think carefully about what he wanted to tell his aunt, and on top of that, he should remember to keep his sentences short, not because he wasn't capable of reading long sentences now, but writing was a different story, and since printing the letters was a slow process, she didn't want it to run out of steam and stop before the end. "Dear Aunt Mildred," Ferguson wrote as his grandmother spelled out the words for him in her high, undulating voice, drawing out the sound of each letter as if it were a little song, the melody rising and falling as his hand inched across the page. "I fell out of a tree and broke my leg. Nana is here. She is teaching me how to read and write. Francie painted my cast blue, red, and yellow. She is mad about those people who fried in the chair. The birds are singing in the yard. Today I counted 11 kinds of birds. The yellow finches are my favorites. I read The Tale of Two Bad Mice and Pee-wee the Circus Dog. What do you like better, vanilla or chocolate ice cream? I hope you will visit soon. Love, Archie." There was some disagreement over the use of the word fried, which his grandmother thought was an excessively vulgar way to talk about a tragic event. But Ferguson insisted there was no choice. The language couldn't be changed because that was how Francie had presented the matter to him, and he found it a good word precisely because it was so vivid and disgusting. Anyway, it was his letter, wasn't it, and he could write anything he wanted to. Once again, his grandmother shook her head. "You never back down, do you, Archie?" To which her grandson answered, "Why should I back down when I'm right?" Not long after they sealed up the letter, Ferguson's mother unexpectedly came home. Chugging down the street in the red two-door Pontiac she'd been driving since the family moved to West Orange 3 years ago, the car that Ferguson and his parents referred to as the Jersey Tomato. And when she had finished putting it away in the garage, she came striding across the lawn in the direction of the porch, moving at a faster pace than she normally did, an accelerated clip that fell somewhere between walking and jogging. And once she was close enough for Ferguson to distinguish her features, he saw that she was smiling, a big smile, an unusually big and brilliant smile. And then she lifted her arm and waved to her mother and son, a warm salutation, a sign that She was in excellent spirits, and even before she walked up the steps and joined them on the porch, Ferguson knew exactly what she was going to say, for it was clear from her early return and the buoyant expression on her face that her long search was finally over. The site for her photography studio had been found. It was in Montclair, she told them, just a short jump from West Orange, and not only was the place large enough to fit in everything she would need, it was plop in the middle of the main drag. There was work to be done, of course, but the lease didn't start until September 1st, which would give her enough time to draw up the plans and start construction on day one. What a relief, she said. Good news at last. But there was still a problem. She had to come up with a name for the studio, and she didn't like any of her ideas so far. Ferguson Photo was no good because of the double F sound. Montclair Photo was too bland. Portraits by Rose was too pretentious. Rose Photo didn't work because of the double O sound. Suburban Portraits made her think of a sociology textbook. Modern Image wasn't bad, but it made her think of a magazine about photography rather than a flesh-and-blood studio. Ferguson Portraiture, Camera Central, F-Stop Photo, Darkroom Village, Lighthouse Square, Rembrandt Photo, Vermeer Photo, Rubens Photo, Essex Photo. No good, she said. They all stank, and her brain had gone numb. Ferguson chimed in with a question. What was the name of the place where his father had taken her dancing, he asked. Something with the word rose in it. The place where they'd gone before they were married. He remembered that she told him about it once because they'd had such a good time there, that they'd danced their heads off. Roseland, his mother said. Then Ferguson's mother turned to her own mother and asked her what she thought of Roseland Photo. I like it, her mother said. And you, Archie, his mother asked, what do you think? I like it too, he said. So do I, his mother said. It might not be the best name ever invented, but it has a nice ring to it. Let's sleep on it. If we still like it in the morning, maybe the problem is solved. That night, as Ferguson and his parents and his grandmother lay asleep in their beds on the second floor of the house, Three Brothers' homeworld burned to the ground. The telephone rang at 5:15 in the morning, and within minutes, Ferguson's father was in his bottle-green Plymouth driving to Newark to inspect the damage. Since the air conditioner was going at full blast in Ferguson's room, he slept through the telephone call and the commotion of his father's hasty pre-dawn departure. And it wasn't until he woke at 7 that he found out what had happened. His mother looked agitated, more confused and distraught than Ferguson had ever seen her. No longer acting as the rock of composure and wisdom he had always thought she was, but someone just like himself, a fragile being prey to sadness and tears and hopelessness. And when she put her arms around him, he felt frightened, not just because his father's store had burned down and there would be no more money for them to live on, which meant they would have to move to the poorhouse and subsist on porridge and dried out pieces of bread for the rest of their days. No, that was bad enough, but the truly frightening thing was to learn that his mother was no stronger than he was, that the blows of the world hurt her just as much as they hurt him, and that except for the fact that she was older, there was no difference between them. Your poor father, his mother said. He spent his whole life building up that store. He's worked and worked and worked, and now it all comes to nothing. A person lights a match, an electric wire short circuits in a wall, and 20 years of hard work turn into a pile of ashes. God is cruel, Archie. He should protect the good people of this world, but he doesn't. He makes them suffer just as much as the bad ones. He kills David Raskin. He burns down your father's store. He lets innocent people die in concentration camps. And they say he's a kind and merciful God. What a joke. His mother paused. Small tears were glistening in her eyes, Ferguson noticed. And she was chewing on her lower lip, as if she were trying to prevent more words from coming out of her mouth, as if she understood she had already gone too far, that she had no right to express such bitterness in front of a 6-year-old child. Don't worry, she said. I'm just upset, that's all. Your father has fire insurance, and nothing is going to happen to us. A nasty bit of luck is what it is, but it's only temporary, and in the end we'll all be fine. You know that, Archie, don't you? Ferguson nodded, but only because he didn't want his mother to be upset anymore. Yes, maybe they would be fine, he thought. And then again, if God was as cruel as she said he was, maybe they wouldn't. Nothing was certain. For the first time since he'd come into the world, 2,325 days ago, all bets were off. Not only that, but who on earth was David Raskin?